This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Welcome once again to the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast for our 25th episode and the start of our third season. For this episode, we look at a clinical trial recently published in the JCENM that helps shed light on the relatively understudied question of an appropriate steroid regimen in congenital adrenal hyperplasia in a population ranging from children to young adults. This type of study obviously brings with it the potential for changing our clinical practice for these patients, so we will think about that along the way and end our session on that very question. For today, as usual for the Endocrine Feedback Loop, we have three endocrinologists for this discussion. I will do my best to represent the adult endocrinology side. I work as a general adult endocrinologist at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center, where I also direct our main outpatient clinics and serve as one of the associate directors for our fellowship program. Joining me again today as our regular contributor for this episode is Marcella Vargas. Marcella practices as a pediatric endocrinologist at Rady Children's Hospital in San Diego and is an assistant clinical professor at UC San Diego. Her clinical interests are in differences of sex development and puberty, and so align nicely with today's topic. Our guest expert today is Selma Witchell from the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. Her distinguished career in pediatric endocrinology is focused on differences of sex development, androgen excess, and disorders in steroidogenesis. I think you, as our listeners, will agree that I have a great pair of endocrinologists joining me today for this discussion, and welcome them both to the podcast. As is also always the case, everything that we say will be our opinions only and not those of either our respective institutions or the Endocrine Society. For this month of the podcast, we review optimizing the timing of highest hydrocortisone dose in children and adolescents with 21-hydroxylase deficiency. The Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism published this article in April 2022. Mariska Schroeder from Radboud University in the Netherlands served as the first author for this study, with several authors from other Dutch institutions. Marcella, I'll turn our discussion over to you so that you can go through the author's introduction to highlight their main points, as well as having Selma give us insight into several key aspects of CAH. Marcella?
Thank you, Chase. So I will start by going over the main points of the introduction from this paper. So first, congenital adrenal hyperplasia, or CAH, is usually due to a deficiency in 21-alpha-hydroxylase. This results in impaired cortisol production, and in some patients, it can also cause impaired aldosterone production. So I'm actually going to stop here and ask Selma to please give us an overview of the clinical manifestations of CAH.
Thank you for the introduction, and thank you for including me in this series. I'm very excited to be here. So the congenital adrenal hyperplasias are a group of disorders that are characterized by impaired glucocorticoid biosynthesis, and 21-hydroxylase is the most common. It's due to mutations in the 21-hydroxylase gene. And with this, there's impaired glucocorticoid synthesis, accumulation of steroid precursors, loss of negative feedback inhibition, and increased ACTH secretion. So as a general rule of thumb, the adrenal can't make enough glucocorticoids, but makes whatever hormones it can, which are largely C19 adrenal steroids, which are typically pre-androgens, but can get converted to more potent androgens. So there are several gradations of congenital adrenal hyperplasia. There's really two forms, the classical and the non-classical, and the classical can be subdivided into the salt losing and the simple virilizing. And I'll, for the purposes of this conversation, lump the classical and the simple virilizing into the same bucket. So the classical and simple virilizing are children who have significantly impaired glucocorticoid activity. Salt losers cannot make enough aldosterone as well, and so they have mineralocorticoid deficiency. These infants are generally identified in infancy. With the girls, because of the impaired glucocorticoid biosynthesis and overproduction of the adrenal C19 androgen-like hormones, baby girls have atypical development of their external genitalia. The traditional word has been ambiguous, but I prefer the word atypical to describe the genital development. And so that's the clinical clue at the time of birth that these girls have a disorders of steroidogenesis. Baby boys look perfectly normal. Fortunately, we have newborn screening tests in all 50 states to recognize them, because prior to newborn screening, baby boys would go home and get very ill. But this is classical endometrial hyperplasia, which is really a spectrum from salt losing to simple virilizing, again, with loss of glucocorticoid and or mineralocorticoids. As these children grow, they require glucocorticoid and mineralocorticoid replacement. There's a milder form, non-classic, which may present not so much with glucocorticoid acute deficiency, but with the manifestations of increased E19 steroids. So these are children that may present with premature pubic hair development, body odor. Boys can present with a large penis and small testes. Girls can present with clitoromegaly and identified later on, but due to a milder variant in the enzyme mutation. And for all forms, treatment involves replacing with glucocorticoids, and in the severe salt losers, mineralocorticoid. And latest recommendations suggest that for some simple virilizers, that adding mineralocorticoid replacement is beneficial as well.
So focusing on the therapy, we know that the main goals of therapy are, one, to replace glucocorticoid deficiency, and two, to suppress excessive androgen production. So the aim really is to achieve good control of that androgen excess, but being very careful to not completely suppress ACTH production. And this is to avoid glucocorticoid excess. So it can be challenging to balance this. And it is thought that the timing of the steroid administration may actually play a role in keeping this balance. So usually hydrocortisone is given 3 times daily, and the highest dose is either given in the morning or in the evening. So clinicians do it either way. Those who give the highest dose in the morning typically try to mimic a physiological circadian rhythm. And those who prefer to give the highest dose in the evening try to suppress better the androgen production that is the highest typically in the early morning. Now, the question is if giving the highest dose in the evening may affect nocturnal blood pressure and sleep. So, Selma, I want to stop here one more time and ask you to please share with us what has been usual practice and what do you actually do in your own practice and why?
So back when I was a fellow many, many years ago, I thought this was relatively straightforward. You know, we replace the hormones that are missing and life goes on. As I had more experience with practice, I realized that this is a very delicate tightrope between balancing undertreatment and overtreatment. And probably during the average day, that's what we do for all the patients. That some period of time after a dose, they're probably overtreated and their bodies are seeing too much glucocorticoid. And right before the next dose, they're undertreated and they're seeing too many C19 androgens. So I traditionally have, and again, largely because that's how I was trained, was to dose 3 times a day, roughly every 8 hours. And as I would tell families, first thing in the morning, last thing before bed, and then as much as the middle of day as possible. Again, thinking back and probably more theoretical than practical, how I was trained and what I have trained is to give the highest dose at night with the theory that if you give the highest dose at night, you're likely going to suppress the ACTH surge through the middle of the night. It turns out when you study things more carefully, that's probably not true, but still it's a habit that's hard to break of giving the highest dose at night. There are other centers where they give the highest dose in the morning. And I just, for the purpose that I looked up, the IDSD did a summary of data and again, quite variable. There's a 2020 Cochrane review that say the data are inadequate to designate optimal glucocorticoid replacement. And sort of as a sideline, some of my patients and parents have thought about this as well as I have and thought, well, you know, maybe 3 times a day isn't enough. Maybe we should treat our kids 4 or 5 times a day. And I think I have one family that even treats their kids 6 times a day. It's not something that I would prescribe to a family because I'm asking for a major effort to be up through the middle tonight to prescribe medicine. But I think it might be more efficacious, particularly those families that have made the choice to give a dose somewhere between 1 and 3 o'clock in the morning. And as we'll talk later about this study, I think we need to reconsider our traditional approach to dosing every 8 hours.
Yeah. So as you just said, you know, there is minimal data to support that there's one strategy that is better than the other. And so this study wanted to look at exactly this question of, you know, is there a regimen that is superior to the other? So they evaluated both standard regimens, which are giving the highest dose in the morning versus giving the highest dose in the evening, and they evaluated primary and secondary outcomes. The primary outcome was biochemical disease control, or in other words, hormone levels. And the secondary outcomes included overnight blood pressure, sleep, and daytime activity scores. So, you know, they did not explicitly mention a hypothesis in the paper. However, based on the outcomes that they evaluated and based on what we know about physiology of steroid replacement, we could infer that the hypothesis is that when we give the highest dose in the evening, we might be able to achieve a better biochemical control, but maybe this is at the expense of worsening overnight blood pressure, sleep, and daytime activity scores.
Thanks. That was the perfect setup for me because it nicely illustrates why we need a study like this. It's a decision that every time we see one of these patients, and for particularly our pediatric colleagues, something that you guys are deciding probably every day, multiple times, that we have very little data on. And it's often just, well, I do it because that's the way I was trained, or that's the way it makes the most sense. But as far as actual hard outcomes, we don't have those. So I think really illustrates, hey, this is why we need a study like this. Okay, so now let's start looking at this study. As we usually do, we're going to step back a little bit and think about study design overall, because I think that's really helpful here. And the reason for that is because these authors use a crossover trial. We've looked at those a few times in this podcast series, but we'll remind everybody because it's a particularly strong trial design. And it is a clinical trial design. And what it does is it uses the same groups of individuals, the same subjects for all of the groups that are investigated. And maybe makes the most sense to describe when you think about it as a more traditional trying a medication versus a placebo, which is different here. But in that, you have all of the subjects tried the medication at one point, and then there are also the groups that do the placebo, or in this study, as we'll see, do an alternative regimen. And the reason that this is such a strong study design is that it's particularly good about dealing with confounders. We think about confounders a lot in observational studies, and the reason for that is because a confounder is something that goes along with the exposure of interest and is actually the driver of the outcomes and may not be recognized very well. Clinical trials, usual clinical trials, RCTs, deal with this in a couple of different methods. One of them is having a relatively large sample size. And then the key next step is randomizing folks into one group or the other, or sometimes multiple groups. And the reason that works is not that it gets rid of the confounders. It's just that if you have enough folks and you've randomized them, you have balanced those confounders. And so to speak about it informally, they cancel each other out. They balance each other out because they're equally present in all of the groups that you are investigating. Crossover trials do this yet another step in that because it's the exact same folks in each of those groups, they perfectly balance each other out. So again, they're there, but they shouldn't have an effect on the outcomes that we're looking at. Okay, so those are crossover trials overall. We'll look at this. This has a few differences from some other types of crossover. So we're going to think about that here. As we think about exposure, I mentioned this before, it's a little bit different. So this isn't a group that's been treated and then a group that's not treated at all. Obviously, these are folks who require steroid replacement. And so in all the groups, it's just different treatment regimens that are being compared to one another. So everyone's being exposed to some degree, and it really depends on which one you would consider the exposure of interest. We don't have a clearly stated hypothesis, as Marcella pointed out, so it's a little bit hard to apply that terminology here, but it is a comparison of two different hydrocortisone regimens, either the highest dose in the morning or the highest dose in the evening. And the outcomes that are looked at, as Marcella already walked through for us, are primarily looking at those hormone levels, but then also some secondary outcomes of blood pressure, sleep, and activity scores as well. Now, one thing that I want us to stop and think about a little bit, and I'll get Marcella and Selma's input here, is that this doesn't have all of the hallmarks that you might like to see in a crossover trial. There's a couple reasons for that, is that this study does not appear to have been either randomized or blinded. So to think about randomization, that makes sense. And in more typical clinical trials is that you're randomized to be treated or not treated or have a comparator group. In this one, typically with crossover trials, what happens is you're randomized as to which group you start with. And so that's a random allocation, and then you switch to the other one later. So this one doesn't have that one. And we'll look at exactly how folks were assigned to their initial treatment here in just a second. But the other thing I think that's probably a bit more important is that folks are not blinded here. So the subjects know the different type of steroids that they're taking. speaking, or at least that's all the indication that we have here. And this has maybe less of an impact for the objective data, which is the primary outcome, which is key. Those are just numbers that we're going to get, but it can have an impact on subjective outcomes. And that definitely comes into play when we think about sleep scores and activity scores. So Marcella, we'll maybe start with you. Any concerns that you might have about that and things that we would need to be thinking about moving forward in light of that?
Definitely, that's a limitation. I would like to add that in this particular study, there were some subjects that were young children, and so they could not have done this course by themselves or interpreted the questionnaire. So these data had to be interpreted by their caregivers, and this definitely adds another layer of subjectivity.
Great. Selma, any thoughts on that particular point?
Enthusiasm for a study is greater at the beginning. So again, with the crossover, did parents get tired of doing this study because they had to, you know, for last 2 days, I think there was a lot of sleep deprivation. There were not a lot of details about how you collect saliva, particularly saliva from a sleeping four-year-old. So I guess that also raises the question of, during the time they had to collect saliva samples, did they have to awaken the children? And is that another confounder or limitation that wasn't even discussed because we have disturbed sleep? But I think there are lots of good things about collecting the samples over time to try and answer the question about whether giving the higher dose in the morning or higher dose in the evening is optimal, but some limitations to the design.
But so we're going to keep both of those points in mind, and then we'll come back to those as we go along. And some of the details of this study design and the inclusion criteria in the protocol have been referenced already. So let's actually go into those in more detail. So the inclusion criteria, so you had to have a diagnosis of CAH. And again, that was due to 21-hydroxylase deficiency, and it had to be confirmed by both hormonal and mutational analysis. The age of inclusion here started at age of 4. So Marcella mentioned quite a few of these folks were young children, but did go all the way up to 20. So the authors describe that as adolescence, but I think is worth highlighting that for adult endocrinologists like me and many of our listeners, this would be in an age group that we would be treating. And they had to get into the trial, had to be receiving treatment with hydrocortisone according to the CAH guidelines that the Endocrine Society most recently published in 2018. So it had to be a relatively standard regimen based on that. And as Selma mentioned there, the salivary sampling was key here. And so the subject had to be able to participate in salivary collection, either by themselves or with the assistance of a caregiver, as Marcella pointed out. So a key exclusion criteria is that you couldn't be taking any other medications with the exception of fludrocortisone for those folks who had aldosterone deficiency. And then the population that was here, I think Marcella, when she and I were analyzing this article early on, had a good point. So it just stated that it's children with CAH that were in the Netherlands who were invited to participate. But Marcella, you thought maybe even more of a strength than the authors highlight is that this may be a multi-center trial, as that at least the authors were from numerous institutions, and so likely that's where the subjects, their patients, were coming from. So likely actually another strength of this study. Okay, so the actual protocol here. And this says, we'll start with the medication administration. So overall, this was a 6-week study, and there were 3 weeks where the subjects were receiving the highest hydrocortisone dose in the morning, and then there were 3 weeks where the highest dose was received in the evening. And then that could be in one direction or the other. And the way that it happened, we mentioned that this wasn't a random allocation to which one you started with. You started with whichever one your regimen was already with. So your usual regimen of highest in the morning or highest in the evening, that was the one that you started with. And so we talked about this before, but so that doesn't count as randomization because you, for some reason, had already been taking that. So that does introduce some potential bias there. And as we mentioned before, the subjects weren't blinded. So they knew which dose they were starting with, either the subjects themselves or their caregivers. And then they knew when they switched to another one. And that one question I was interested in, and Selma, maybe we'll get your input here. So they just started with that same total daily dose. They maybe reassigned a little bit exactly when you were taking that, but there wasn't a major redoing of how much hydrocortisone that you were taking throughout the day. And so one can imagine a different scenario where you say you totally started from scratch, you use some empiric formula that's based on weight or body surface area to come up with a total daily dose. And so that way you're assigning everybody a very standardized regimen based on that. So they didn't do this. They started with whatever total daily dose the subjects were taking. Any thoughts about that? Would you agree that this is the way they did it was the way to go? Or maybe you would have advocated for a slightly different approach to assigning the actual dose of the steroid itself?
I think it'd be hard to just give an arbitrary dose, say everybody should be on 12 milligrams per meter squared per day, because I think treatment in CH is very individualized, and some patients metabolize glucocorticoids faster or slower. Teenagers in particular seem to metabolize them faster. So I think starting with what the patient was taking was the appropriate decision.
Good. I agree. I think that makes sense. And particularly the authors have highlighted already that all of the folks who are involved here, they had treatment regimens that were in line with guidelines. So nobody had highly unusual or weird regimens. This is all standard of care, though with some maybe mild differences between them. Okay, good. So a few more words then on what those steroid regimens look like. So the way that they work, they continue the same total daily dose, but the subjects would receive around half, so about 40 to 50% of that total daily dose as a single dose, either in the morning or the evening. And then that other 50 to 60% of the total daily dose was equally distributed between the two other doses. So a total of three doses a day has been already described. The authors point out that if the subjects needed to stress dose for an illness that happened to occur during the study, they didn't measure anything at that time. They deferred some of the regimen, the measurements of the hormones. But the laboratory measurements, and again, this is the primary outcome that the authors are focused on, consisted of what I'll walk through here. So it is a salivary collection, as we mentioned already, and these were done on the last 2 days of each of the treatment periods. And the four times a day that they would do that, so first thing in the morning, that's 5 a.m., and then a little bit later in the morning, 7 a.m., and then 3 p.m., so mid-afternoon, and then late in the evening at 11 p.m. And of note, those last three measurements, those were all immediately before a steroid dose was given. And with the salivary collection, they did a couple of things were measured, and that's a 17-hydroxyprogesterone level, and then an interesting down level was also measured. And then with that, with those two measurements, the authors were then able to classify each patient as undertreated, adequately treated, or overtreated. So this is where I really wanted to get Selma's input to help us understand things here. So as far as these salivary measurements, I don't think I have ever ordered either of these. So I was curious from your perspective, is this a fairly standardized, first of all, the assay itself? So are those relatively straightforward measurements? Do we have any concerns about how those hormones are measured? But also, is there a fairly standard agreement on how to interpret those? So is there, everyone's on the same page, what overtreatment looks like, undertreatment looks like, at least from a biochemical perspective, or do we need to worry that maybe that's not the same in all the centers that take care of these folks?
Typically, I don't order salivary hormone levels, but I know other people have. This is done by a very reputable laboratory using state-of-the-art equipment and standardization. So I don't have any concerns about the assays themselves. However, typically we measure 17-hydroxyprogesterone and androstenedione in plasma, not necessarily in saliva for our patients. So again, the choice of those hormones are, again, part of it is tradition. 17-hydroxyprogesterone is the substrate for the defective enzyme. And so that's part of the reason we've measured that. That's really used more as an indicator of overtreatment. So if the 17-hydroxyprogesterone level is low, that would suggest the patient is overly suppressed with glucocorticoid treatment. Androstenedione also has a relatively short half-life. So if you give a dose, and the author showed here in several other papers, that typically within hours, 17-hydroxyprogesterone is suppressed. However, its levels begin to rise before 6 to 8 hours later as the effectiveness of cortisol wears off. It depends on the glucocorticoid one's using. In kids, most of the time we use hydrocortisone. So we use that more as a marker of overtreatment. Androstenedione, on the other hand, has a longer half-life in plasma, and it's generally considered to be a better marker of undertreatment. So the goal would be to keep the androstenedione in the range that's appropriate for sex, age, and pubertal status. And so ideally, you want your 17-hydroxyprogesterone to be a little higher than the normative values and the androstenedione to be within range for, again, sex, age, and stage of pubertal development.
Thanks. That is helpful insight for us. Okay, just a few words then on the secondary outcomes. So three of those that they looked at, again, the nocturnal blood pressure. So those were measurements that were done one night on the last week of each of those treatment regimens at 1 hour intervals. And the study investigators supplied the blood pressure machine so that could be done at home. There were also sleeping scores and activity scores that were scored on a daily basis and reported back to the investigators. And just a couple of brief words on the statistics. So the authors did a power power calculation as was appropriate and determined that about 39 patients would be needed in order to detect a clinically meaningful differences between these two regimens. And then finally, the authors note that they couldn't do a washout period here. So that's often with a crossover study. That's something that's typically done is if you're going to try one medication, you'll do that for a period of time, and then you will give the subjects a break off of that to allow any effects of that to wear off before they cross over to the other arm. Obviously, with steroids in the CAH population, that couldn't be done. So what the authors did is they investigated to see, might there be a carryover effect where the effects of one treatment arm them actually have an impact on the other one when the subjects switch over. They didn't see that, so they were not worried about that, and they didn't need to make any adjustments based on that. So now at this point, we're going to start looking at the results. Marcella, now that we've gone through how the authors did this study, why don't you walk us through the results that they found with their methodology?
Sure. So let's start with the results for the primary outcome. So the primary outcome was the differences in hormonal levels between both regimens. So when they averaged the hormone levels, they found out that mean androstenedione and 17-OHP were not different between both regimens, meaning the ones who received the highest dose in the morning versus those who received the highest dose in the evening. On the other hand, both 17-OHP and androstenedione levels were both significantly different between time points. And so what this means is that the effect of the treatment regimen did differ within the different time points. So for example, when the highest dose was given in the morning, this resulted in lower afternoon 17-OHP and androstenedione levels, but higher levels in the early morning pertaining 17-OHP. So table one actually shows these results very nicely. And we can see there that when the levels were measured at 5 a.m., 17-OHP was significantly lower in those who had received the highest dose in the evening. Androstenedione was also lower. However, this was not significant between both groups. It is important to note that when they measured the levels at 7 a.m., there was actually no difference in either of the levels in between groups. So what this means is that the effect that we saw on lower androgen levels at 5 a.m. when the highest dose was given in the evening did not persist through 7 a.m. They also showed that afternoon levels were significantly lower for both 17-OHP and androstenedione in the group that received the highest dose in the morning. Another result that they showed is that there was some inter-individual variability, and they actually did further analysis to see if there were any factors that they could identify that were associated with the variability among these individuals, but they did not find any subgroup of factors that could explain this variability. And then they also looked at the hormonal control, as Chase alluded to earlier, and they found that the morning hormonal control was comparable between both regimens. So basically, those who were in optimal control were those who had 17-OHP above the upper reference limit and androstenedione below. Those who were overtreated with those who had both hormone levels below the upper reference limit, and those who were undertreated were those who had both levels above the upper reference limit. So they looked at the different times for both regimens, and they noted how many individuals were optimally controlled versus under or overtreated. And we can see this data on table three, where they show that the number of optimally controlled subjects is very similar on morning and evening levels for both groups, but lower on afternoon levels for those who received the highest dose in the evening. The other result that they showed in this study pertaining the hormone levels was that both regimens did show that there was diurnal variation between the hormone levels. So in other words, circadian rhythm was maintained on both regimens. They did show that when the highest dose was given in the evening, the circadian rhythm was less pronounced. However, this was not significant. And this is nicely shown on figure one. Now, regarding the secondary outcomes, they showed that the sleep rating did not differ between both groups. So they did an analysis during the last week of each treatment, and they found that the lower scores were found in the group that received the highest evening dose However, this was not really significant, as we can see on figure two. For daytime activity scores, there was also no difference between both treatment regimens. And they did show that the mean was highest in the afternoon for both groups. And there was a statistical difference between morning and evening scores when compared to the afternoon scores. However, this was not different in between regimens. And lastly, regarding nocturnal blood pressure, they saw that there was no difference between the high morning or high evening regimens. And this was true for both systolic and diastolic blood pressures. So now I'm going to turn it back to you, Chase, so that you can review the discussions and conclusions from this study.
Thanks, Marcella. I'm going to give you the conclusions that the authors state initially, and then we're going to wrestle with a few different things. They mention a few practical considerations, and then we're really going to take a deep dive and think about, well, how do we apply this to our clinical practice? But first of all, so there are a few conclusions, three of them from the author. So first of all, they say no difference in the mean steroid levels throughout the day was observed. So that's their main conclusion. And then a couple more, the second one being that the higher evening dose did not substantially affect the sleep rating, the daily activity scores, or the nocturnal blood pressure. And then finally, no treatment regimen was found to be superior. So a few practical implications that we'll deal with first before we think about this overall. And with both of these, I'm going to get Marcella and Selma to give us some insight here. And this first one, we'll start with Selma. So the authors state that the lower 17-hydroxyprogesterone levels that were seen with that higher dose in the evening regimen, that lower level at 5 a.m., was not seen by 7 a.m. Marcella pointed that out already. And so the authors say that suggests that the importance of taking the evening dose as late as possible and the morning dose as early as possible should really be emphasized to patients because of that impact there. So Selma, your thoughts on that? Do you see these the data here supporting that recommendation that we pass along to patients?
Right. It goes along with sort of our original, I think it was more belief because we didn't have the data, that giving a higher dose at night would suppress the ACTH surge. And here our data is showing that that's not really the case. When you have the data to look at, ACTH surge is happening earlier, and maybe medicine's helping because we've seen that a little bit with these data. But by 6 or 7 a.m., the efficacy of the higher dose at night has worn off and the levels have started to rise. So again, that speaks to trying to make that late night dose as late as possible. So again, you try to lower the ACTH surge in the middle of the night. And then I have to, you know, applaud my families that decide that they're going to give a dose at 1 o'clock in the morning, because that is probably much more efficacious than giving the bedtime dose at 9 p.m.
Marcella, thoughts on that particular point?
Yeah, I mean, something that is interesting is that the evening dose was given at 11, like somewhere between 10 and 11 p.m. for the subjects in this study, which is actually quite late. Again, going back to the younger patients, you know, this is usually past their bedtime. So how much are you going to interfere with their quality of life or sleep by actually giving the dose after they've gone to sleep? Or how much are you going to trust those adolescents that do go late to bed to take the dose without parental supervision? So while in theory, it does make sense, you know, try to give the dose as late as possible, are we really making a significant difference or a benefit? Are we benefiting our patients even when the effect actually did not last through 7 a.m.? So it does raise a good question. Like Selma said, it has been the dogma and what we followed, but these data might actually show that, is it worth it or not, basically?
Yeah, and we're going to come back to that whole idea of how do we interpret this data as we move forward to what do we recommend to our patients. So let's sit tight on that. One other practical consideration I want us to think about, and Marcella, I'll stick with you here with this, is that the authors again point out what Marcella herself already mentioned in the results, is that there was substantial interpatient variability in both of those hormone levels, the 17-hydroxyprogesterone and the androstenedione. So Marcella, what would you take from that? Well, there is a lot of differences here, even with folks who are on relatively similar regimens, is that the results of the actual hormone levels can be fairly substantially different.
Yeah, I think actually this might be one of the most valuable results from this study, or at least one of the take-home points, because while we cannot make conclusions of which regimen is superior based on the results, we did see that there was a lot of inter-individual variability, and we do know from experience that patients metabolize steroids differently, as Selma already alluded to. So I think, you know, this could be useful in particular situations. Something that comes to mind, for example, patients that on biochemical with the biochemical profile, we think that they're under good control, but clinically, they're not doing that great. For example, they are still showing clinical signs of androgen excess or their bone age continues to advance. I think in this situation, it might be helpful to think, you know, is this patient reacting or responding differently to the regimen that I'm giving him or her? And so it might be a good situation to consider maybe even measuring hormones at different times of the day. I mean, normally I do this, and I know many people do. We tell our patients to check hormone levels at the same time of the day to be consistent and be able to compare levels from one measurement to the other. But in this situation, it might be worthwhile maybe measuring levels at different times of the day to see really what the biochemical control is throughout the day, or maybe even trying a different regimen for the patient, switching the highest dose from the evening to the morning, as we saw some patients responded better to one regimen than the other. So in particular, those patients in which we suspect that despite good levels, they might not be getting good biochemical control throughout the day, it might be helpful to remember that there's a lot of differences between the responses from one individual to another.
I think variability for even somebody who doesn't have congenital adrenal hyperplasia, your cortisol secretion varies throughout the day, depending on what you're doing, if you're sick, you're stressed because there's an exam coming. In addition to the normal diurnal rhythm, there's a lot of variability. So we're trying to mimic that individual variability by giving medication three times a day. And again, the study highlights the individual variability. And again, goes to one data point at one point in time to decide whether somebody's in good control. And I think that in some ways is artificial. Marcella knows from past years of working together that I would look at where the child is on the growth curve. What's the growth velocity? What's the bone age? And what are the hormone levels? And it's really taking the composite to say, yes, my patient's on a reasonable dose, recognizing that there's no way for the patient to be having levels that aren't too high or aren't too low throughout the whole 24-hour period. You're just doing your best approximation, trying to keep the patient from having significant hyperandrogenism, while at the same time trying to avoid significant glucocorticoid excess. So despite my original thought in fellowship that this was easy, this is a very complicated disease to care for.
Well, and we'll come back to that here at the end. So a few things I want us to touch on first, and this is the authors list, some strengths of their studies and also some limitations. So we'll go through those. So first of all, the strengths that the authors mentioned, they report that a strength of it is the salivary testing. And they point out that this was able to avoid any stress-induced changes from the phlebotomy, from blood draws itself, and that the other data has shown that salivary levels are nicely correlated with serum levels. And they point out that in this study, no hospitalization was required. So it was a better look at what these levels and in response to treatment would look like in real life, so to speak. And then finally, they point out that they had highly motivated subjects, which then ties in as we move into the limitations. As they say, one of the limitations is that they couldn't control for compliance here. But again, because of strength was having highly motivated subjects, they hope that that was likely a minimal limitation for them. They point out that testing was intermittent. So even though it was four times a day, which is a relatively high amount, that it was not continuous. So potential some limitations there of what's being missed. And then as a final limitation, that they do point out that the assessment, that salivary testing was done immediately before a dose was given. So they didn't know what happened in just the few hours immediately after a dose. So that time period, how people respond was a little unclear because they weren't looking at that until the next dose was due. So the author's summary of their finding, which I think we would all agree with, is that the dose regimens were comparable. But where I would like us to think about is this final recommendation or maybe even implication that they state, and I'll quote it here, is they say, we recommend individually determining the best timing of the highest hydrocortisone dose based on levels of 17-hydroxyprogesterone and androstenedione at multiple time points during the day. And we'll start with Selma here, but I just wanted to think about this overall, and I'll maybe play devil's advocate and state it a different way. As I would say, the authors just in all of their data just pointed out that two very different regimens lead to the exact same results. And yet they say we should do lots of different testing to try to figure out exactly which different regimen we should be using, even though their results just show that it doesn't seem to make a difference which regimen that you use. So what are your thoughts on particularly that implication overall, the overall study design and the quality of the results? What are your thoughts there?
I think the study design was very interesting. It's nice that patients could be in their own home because, again, going back to sleep, putting somebody in a hospital to do this clearly would interfere with sleep, but we don't know for sure how well the children slept. The sleep was determined by an observer. I don't know if there are sleep watches or Fitbits, mine on my wrist, to sort of talk about sleep. Could they have done that as well to sort of give a better idea of what was happening with activity even throughout the day? That would have been a nice thing to add to the study. In some ways, it's reassuring that either treatment approach is okay. So none of us have to beat ourselves up that we've been treating CAH the wrong way over all these years. And I think it really is important to have an individualized approach. But I think the importance of this study and many of the other studies that have been done looking at dosing is that it's time to go beyond our traditional box of how we treat CAH. I came across a couple articles suggesting that we should maybe switch to dosing 4 times a day. And that might do better. It's also time to think about novel therapeutics. There's CRF1 antagonists. I don't know much about, there's an ACTH monoclonal antibody that's in early phases, gene therapy, MC2R antagonists. So I think the impetus for the study is to say, we're doing okay. You know, our patients grow, they are productive, they become adults, but what else could we be doing to improve quality of life and control? And we're pediatricians, so our kids go off to college and everything's wonderful. We're not adult endocrinologists to see them come in years later in terms of cardiovascular disease or bone disease. So we need to be cognizant in pediatrics, thinking about health of our patients in the long term.
And then Marcella, thoughts about the quality of this report overall?
Yeah, so I'll second what Selma already mentioned, that while the study does have some limitations, which we actually already mentioned, they did do a good job, I think, evaluating hormone levels at different time points. And when you go back in the literature, really most data there do not have as many evaluations throughout the day regarding the hormone levels. So I do think that they did a good job evaluating these. However, with the limitations of the study, you know, there are questions regarding even these hormone levels regarding, for example, were the patients even in good control before entering the study? Were they on a stable dose when they entered the study? We do not have that, as we know that they just went on the prior dose that they were receiving. So in general, while it has its strengths, of course, it also has its limitations. I do think that the finding of the importance of individualizing treatment is, you know, it's a very reasonable recommendation that they're making based on their results and whether it's changing our practice or not. As Selma said, the important thing is to look at the patient as a whole. And something that is eye-opening, you know, especially for us in pediatrics, we do focus a lot on the bone age, the height rate. However, it's important to always keep in mind, are we affecting our patient's sleep? You know, it's something that I might start asking more to my patients, especially those who are receiving the highest dose at night. Or also, are we actually affecting their future cardiovascular risk by just sort of following that dogma of giving the highest dose at night? So I think we're still left with a lot of open questions, but it is good to think through these potential, you know, side effects. Do they outweigh the benefits regarding the regimen that we choose?
And with that, I would like to thank Marcella Vargas and Selma Witchell for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I learned a great deal, as I know that you all did, and hope that you will join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.